This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. In today's episode, we have a fair bit of news to cover, followed by a short segment discussing the announcement of a new chapter pack cycle, and then an AGOT retrospective on 2011 with 2011 Starlight champion Marty Fos Hernandez, or Heron. Finally, we have some closing comments about a very busy upcoming week in regionals. So this is episode 19, and once again, we're recording the same day, a couple hours after I land from my flight.
And once again, we're not giving our regular schedule program, but we're going to be doing a retrospective today.
We have some reasoning behind that. So we decided that to do a Barra episode, if we were going to rehash decks that weren't working in the current meta, Barra has the lowest qualification ratio. It's by far demonstrably the house that is performing the worst in the current meta, and rehashing the decks it's using right now is not a very good idea. So we put a bunch of great minds together to build a deck that we thought could put Barra back on the competitive field, and that's seen some play. It saw some play at the UK regionals, it saw some play at New York, and another deck also emerged at New York, another Barra deck. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to have a bunch of us talk about the Barra Knights of the Hollow Hill that we built that we think is really a very interesting deck and worth playing in this meta. And we're going to get the top-seeded player at New York City to talk about his Barra, the Maester's Path, which went 6-0, the only undefeated deck in the Swiss. So we'll have two actual competitive decks, and hopefully we can jumpstart Barra into the competitive scene this regional season.
Awesome. So we have a couple announcements to go through.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty busy week for FFG related news.
Yeah, we got a spoiler article, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. But we also had two big tournaments. We had the New York tournament, and we had the Polish regional.
I have people that have told me they're going to give me the information. We should have the full stats in the annals very, very shortly, but I don't actually know who won that. Emergency little addition that I'm cutting into this intro, I just got news from the Polish regionals. Apparently it was won by a Stark No Agenda running Mira.
Oh, awesome. That's a good deck, especially if it was the
deck. It's a hard match against Burn, but it's a really good deck.
Yeah.
For those of you who weren't following the New York City tournament, the information is already in the annals, at least partly, and will be filled out over the next couple of days. But the winner of that was out of D.C., Pat Reynolds, with a Greyjoy House of Dreams Longship Maiden's Bane, which is an interesting meta answer to the fact that everybody's teching against the old way, and some of those answers just don't work if you have the House of Dreams on it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, stuff like Gaston would still work.
Yeah, Maiden's Bane has been ruled to lose its immunity when it becomes a character, but regain it when it goes back to being a warship. But that does mean it's much harder to favorable ground it or to remove it in ways like that. It's still affected, obviously, by the plots that are targeting it.
Though. So you went to the New York regional as well. Do you want to give us a really quick... How did you do?
I did 4-2. Still, nobody that's with 4-2. Good. Nobody with 4-2 made the cut. So top 8 with 41 players, so that's a mostly on time points that I slipped from that cut, which is not that surprising with the deck I played. But I had a blast. It was great fun. I was playing a deck I really enjoyed. I won Barra Pounder Counters with a Barra deck, which is nice. Last year I won the Greyjoy House card with a Greyjoy deck, so I was pleased with that as well. And honestly, the tournament was phenomenally run. MDC 273, who many of you may know from the boards, does a great job TOing and organizing that. Dave put so much time, Dave Stroms, who's Vapad and was on the show for the FAQ 5.0 review, put so much time into this. They had a bunch of bonus prize support. Every time you lost a match, you got a coupon for the raffles.
So they had cake.
They had cake. There's a picture of the cake. in the on the Beyond the Wall Facebook group, and you've got to check that out. That was made by Rachel Booth, Seth Booth's wife, and it's a work of art. It was phenomenal, and it was heavy. They needed two people to bring it in. Worth checking out our Facebook group, and then while you're at it, liking our Facebook page. But there are so many people to thank. The entire Boston Meta, they were phenomenal. We went up to their hotel suite that they booked and drank their beer. We had a great time there. They didn't kick us out, despite the fact that they had to head out the next day. Sandy and Morgan together worked to give me a place to stay. I was staying with Sandy Barnabas from the New York City Meta, and Morgan came up as well and brought some things that I needed to stay there so I didn't have to bring extra luggage and toured me a little bit around the city. I mean, this was a tournament done perfectly, and I think that no one could come out of that tournament feeling disappointed with how it played out.
Well, super, you know, good work, New York. I want to do a shout-out to the Montreal Meta. They're a new meta. They've been around for about a year, and I think all three of the guys that went down from there ended up making the cut to the top eight. So
yeah, and good work, two of them were in top four facing off against each other as well. Really, really strong performance for people who had driven down that day. They were exhausted.
Philip told me he had not slept when he finally logged in to say that he was going to bed. It had been a new personal best for him. It was 38 hours
since he had slept. With the drive. I mean, for him to play a black sails deck where you do need to be on the ball and you need to know what you're getting out of your hold and you need to know your opponent's decks, that is just absolutely stellar performance. So, and proved that now I'm what, the fourth best Canadian out of four that showed up at that tournament?
I wouldn't go that far, but it does show that they're a strong meta, and I think, you know, people are going to have some fun between New York and Montreal and coming up, because we did get some visitors from New York at the Montreal, and it actually kind of segments into our next announcement, which is the Canadian national dates have been announced tentatively. I think they're still confirming with FFG, but it looks like it's going to be the August 2nd and August 3rd. It's going to be a combined Melee on the 2nd, Joust on the 3rd, with an overall champion, is my understanding. So people got to come down for that or come up for that, depending on where you are in the world. And we already know that a bunch of the New York guys are going to try to make it.
I think the New York guys mentioned it, the Boston meta. I've heard rumors from further afield than that. This, you know, you can look at it as a Gen Con warm-up if you are much keener on Gen Con, which is like 2 weeks later. It's in Gatineau, which is basically Ottawa, for those of you somewhat familiar with Canadian geography. So it's fairly easy to get to.
Yep. And I've played at the location before. They got lots of tables. It's a big area, so they can probably handle quite a few people. I think it'll be a good time.
Yeah, and I look forward to, I mean, this one's really tight, so my child's due date is the 23rd of July, so, you know, who knows what's going to go on there, but we'll see.
So I heard that our competitive podcast, those 2C1C guys, got a new host.
They did. They had an episode where they had Aaron Glazer as a guest, and clearly it worked so well for them that they've now engaged him as a full-time host, bringing them up to four chumps, I guess? I mean, really? No, sorry, three chumps and one championship-level player?
That's right, the championship-level player is important.
The championship-level player.
If we've got props, you know, that's FFG-certified.
It is from the... This is, for those of you not in the know on that particular bit, Will Lance Kennan from Two Champs, One Chump was referred to by FFG as a championship-level player because normally they get someone to design the decks that come in the deluxe expansions, and they got him to do the one for Lannister, and so he's credited as a championship-level player. No one knows what that means, but as far as I know, he's the only championship-level player.
In the world.
In the world. So yes. It's quite a distinction. But in all seriousness, Aaron is a player who keeps very much abreast of the meta. He does a phenomenal job tracking stats, interpreting that information, practicing games, and
good
testing
player.
Himself. Yeah. He'll be halfway through a game, and then he'll deliberately do something like that he knows is a play mistake so he can practice coming back from it, putting himself in a situation where he's like, well, I would win with this card. What happens if I don't use it? And at the training level, that's... You know, that's a dedication that's very, very hard to pull off.
Yeah. Great deck builder, great player. So I think the cast that was already strong, a lot of good players there, you know, even got better. So congratulations, guys.
It is worth noting, though, that I seeded 10th in the New York City tournament, and he seeded 11th. So I beat him by three strength of schedule points, which
so
really...
Beyond the Wall 1, 2C1C0?
Exactly. The only recent tournament we've both had representatives at. Actually, Gen Con last year probably still counts as well.
Then it's Beyond the Wall 2. 2C1C0.
Yes! Now we just have to not show up to any tournaments to which they also show up. And
ever again, yeah, we'll be fine.
All right. I think that's about it for news.
So there's one last thing, Alex.
Oh.
The article on FFG with the incorrect rules. I mean, that should be close to your heart.
That's right. They published so last week they published a first chapter of this plots articles, which we'd commented on. It was it was not aimed at a very, I would say, championship level player audience then, but it was a good introduction to one of the core mechanics, and I was pleased to see Game of Thrones get some publicity time on the FFG site. So this week they set up a follow-up one, which was primarily on resets and those kinds of plots. But I think there's a specific wording in there that describes the moribund state from which things can be saved, which has nothing to do with the way the rules actually work for moribund.
Yeah,
once you're in moribund,
you're
stuck. Yeah. Saves prevent you from entering moribund. But this it does bring up a common rules mistake where people think of saves as this sort of pulling a character that is moribund or dying and recovering him. And it's actually much more practical to think of a save as dodging an effect or dodging a bullet, because then the timing is the same as cancels for people. If you think it in your head, you can either stop that effect from affecting this character or you can get that character out of the way. That's what the save is. It dodges the effect rather than saying, okay, he got hit by it, but then I'm, patching him up or, resuscitating him.
All right. I think that is truthfully all of the news.
That's a lot of news.
It's a lot of news. So we're joined today for a little segment by Peter Wilson. He's part of the Montreal meta. Just came back from his New York trip where he got to at least play in the same tournament, Alex, if not against him. And top four there, Peter?
Yep, top four.
That's great.
Lost to another meta mate.
But we're not here to talk about tournaments today. We're here to talk about the new cycle that was released called The Wardens. Yeah. What do you think of this cycle, Peter, from the stuff that's been spoiled on the FFG site?
Well, I like that it's trying to focus on a character set that isn't used very often, at least in competitive decks. You try and minimize the number of four-cost characters you use generally. They're not very good on setups, and it's a lot to invest in one character that could die to a no quarter. So incentivizing that kind of thing, I really like.
I'll tell you one thing I don't like. I don't like the name of the first chapter pack. Isn't that basically the same as the previous one? Isn't there a Secrets and Spies or something?
Yeah, that's the name.
This one is Secrets and Schemes. That won't get confusing at all. Given that I already made the mistake at last Gen Con of buying, instead of the Banners Gather, I bought the Calling the Banners chapter pack. So I'm definitely going to screw this one up as well.
So I agree with you. I really like the idea that giving more value to these higher cost characters and that. But I also like some of the stuff that they spoiled in that it seems to be working on, old concepts but in new ways. Stuff like, I won't go to every single card, but, Mord, where he's focusing on shuffling characters with low cost back in, where they're using sky cells to give people random plots and stuff. Like, we've seen these effects before on some of the old epic battles, well, on one of the old epic battles.
Yeah.
And I think it's cool that it's coming back in a different form, and I think in a funner way.
See, I think I wanted to mention that because Peter mentioned they seem to want to emphasize strength 4 characters, but they also seem to want to emphasize it in two different ways. Not only making them cheaper, having an agenda for them, having effects that key off them, but doing the opposite and saying characters that are lower than strength 4, we're going to make them a bit more vulnerable. We're going to put things like Mord, we're going to put things like the Sky Cells, like Cyril and Pain, to act as a disincentive.
How deadly is that, though? Like, how many guys did Jaime Lannister kill that were these two strength chuds? So it's just awesome that, he won't die and all the little chuds would.
I don't think the disincentivizing cost 3s will actually change much in the metagame. I think that, unless there's a whole bunch of it, the jump from cost 3 to cost 4 is pretty huge and will remain huge. I think it's interesting that we already have some thresholds for, like, printed cost 2 with things like First Snow and Strength 2 with things like Venomous Blade that have already sort of played with the 2 range, and now it looks like they're playing with the 3 range.
Yeah, it really isn't going to stop me from playing Demon Dance for me.
Yeah, exactly.
But I might be more worried about trying to protect him in a certain game. I can't rely on him having 3 renown to try and tie up the end of the game.
Another thing they announced this cycle seems to be a new set of plots, or at least you see one plot with this castle trait, and it seems to have a delayed effect. Not super sure I like that.
I do. I think that that's really neat. I was just talking with someone the other day that basically his complaint with rivers and with city plots is that the plot decks there build themselves. If they build a series of castle plots like these, where there's sort of this investment in what you're doing, you say, I'm telling you what I'm going to do next turn. I've got a decent stat line, all this other stuff. But instead of getting a win revealed, I'm going to get something later. I'm banking it for later. You're giving away your position, but you're getting a benefit from it later. But it doesn't key, or doesn't seem to key off other castle plots. So you could put one of them in, you could put two of them in, you can put none of them in. And I think I like that a lot.
So actually, you know, I think the castle plot is something that doesn't key off other castle plots, but something that should give an effect throughout the whole game. If I control a castle, from a Nedley perspective, I want something that happens all the time once it's in my used pile, not something that just happens like a one of. You know, while this plot is in my used pile, all my guys get, I get plus one strength, for instance, when I defend. Maybe not all my guys, maybe just simply plus one strength. And that, to me, would be a cool castle concept.
That would lend itself to putting a whole bunch of castle plots in your deck, to pre-building the plot deck, to saying the first 3 plots are all going to be castles, and then I'm going to be able to use something else. And I think that, again, it's something you have to be careful with.
Well, if I'm kind of wondering why they have the castle trait to begin with. The plot they revealed doesn't really interact with any other castle plots. Are there going to be cards that interact with castle plots in your use pile, recurring the ability or such, or what do you think?
That's actually probably, there probably will be something that interacts with that trait.
Another way
well,
flood
I mean,
waters.
I guess it could just be an identifier. It could just be castle. That's so that when you see it's a castle plot, you know it's one of these delayed effect ones. But I'm inclined to believe Peter's right, that there will be some effects that play with that, or that require you to have a castle in your used pile, or whatever the case is, to work.
Yeah, I think they must have something, otherwise they wouldn't have taken the time to, they probably just would have left it blank.
I think we should at least, if we're not doing all the cards individually, the Aloof and Apart is the agenda that's being introduced in the very first chapter pack, so it's card number 18. I'm guessing that means there'll be 2 plots that follow it, but or other agendas, who knows. But this seems to be an incentive to be able to build your deck around characters with printed cost 4 or higher.
It's also got a very strange interaction, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not letting your cards get back to your hand. Like, if I ambush from the plane something out of my discard pile, it's just going to stay there now, right?
Yeah, I don't think... When I read that, I assumed that it was designed specifically so that you couldn't use it with Gaston Grey and get a ridiculous resource advantage.
Agreed.
And I know there's some debate as to whether or not that works, because technically that's the cost of triggering Gaston Grey, which isn't a card effect. But there are 2 definitions of card effects within the rules, the ones within the rule set, which refer to any effects from a card, and then the ones on many cards, which refer to stuff after the cost. I think it's pretty clear here what this is intending to do. So I think if it does need to get ruled, it will get ruled in such a way that it's all effects of a card, not just things after the cost.
Yeah, I think it's the other card interactions that build to, I don't know, say, I wouldn't say abuse, but you'd be able to use this agenda to help you cheat some stuff in, mostly out of target, I think.
So I'm a little worried with this. I think that it would be a really good idea to emphasize the key characters. I think a lot of people play this game or come into this game knowing characters from the series that they want to play, and then they're told, don't run Ned, he's garbage, except for the one that you can play out of Bera, and he's somewhat useful. Or, you know, they say, don't play these iconic characters. But in an Aloof and Apart deck, you might very well be able to. That said, I have the feeling that that's mostly going to apply to armies.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't think that this will end up really contributing to people playing Eddard Stark so much as Northern Cavalry Flank.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And now you're going to have, you know, 3 flanks and 3 of the warships.
I mean, that being said, I mean, there are some more borderline characters, such as maybe the Blackfish that doesn't make the cut all the time. It'd be a bit easier to put in. So, I mean, that is a positive.
I think it'll be a hard cost curve to build, because you know that you won't be able to drop two of them in that turn. So you'll have to play that somewhat carefully. I think it'll be interesting, but I don't know if it'll push exactly the angle that I think they're intending to. And
all right.
There does seem to be one more theme that they're pushing that you didn't mention. Of the cards spoiled, I see two with limited responses. That's
yeah, that
something we haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we have Castellan, we got Alchemist Guildhall. I think those are the only two in Lannister, right?
No. There's that absolutely amazing Volantis Inn as well.
Oh, you're right. I totally forgot about Volantis Inn.
The one that you get a power after a character has no player card effect.
I don't know how I forgot that.
Oh, wonderful.
But the thing is that in most houses, limited responses mean nothing. You know, you would think that it would be kind of like a restricted choice. Do you really want to run Guildhall and Castellans when you can only trigger one of the two? Or do you really want to run, you know, you make that decision. That's the reason nobody plays Volantis Inn. Well, nobody but James J.C. Wama. But in this case, if they're going to start adding them for other houses, they need to give you two or three viable options for limited response to be meaningful. And I hope they do. I think it's a very simple mechanic. We already know they don't need to introduce new rules, and yet they can play around with that and make powerful effects.
And it really changes, you know, the way you would build a deck, and also the choices you have to make if more than one of those effects is in play. I like the idea, if that's what they're doing.
It might take a while to build up to it, though. I mean, this is probably just the starting point. Even past this cycle, they'll probably continue to produce more limited responses, just as the agenda continues to use prized.
I think that this may be a problem. There was another one. Peter Baelish was spoiled and also had a limited response, so they do seem to be pushing that. But if you're going to do this and then introduce a rotation come November and rotate out old limited responses, you're almost shooting yourself in the foot. As long as there's only one valuable limited response in your house, it's like it's not there. So you've got to be careful then that you don't overpower something like Castellan or something like that because it's the only choice, which I guess you can do with the restricted list in the long run.
There is one more thing that they seem to be trying to address in this new cycle, and it's not, you know, for the Jaime players really, but more for the Nedley players. They're reintroducing the Clansmen, I believe. And they're introducing new Rainbow Guard cards.
Do we
and
really
also
need
the Tullys.
Another trait that will get incomplete support?
Rainbow Guard.
But Clansmen have never quite hit their stride. And if they can push Clansmen or Tully and they say Sand Snake, Dothraki, Raider. Okay. I don't know. I'm somewhat worried about pushing Dothraki and Raider any further. They're actually much better. But people frequently complain about this, about the fact that there are traits that don't get full support. So it's a stated design goal, so we'll see how it plays out. I'm hesitant to say that it'll work for all of those, but if it works for one of those, that'll generally help.
I mean, like you said, Dothraki's already a good deck, so if they add a few more interesting Dothraki, it could be a really good deck.
But while we're on the Nedley aspect, I do have one gripe. The fact that Skycell can't be attached to any version of Tyrion. It's all printed cost 4 or higher. I think that's unfortunate.
Well, he did get out.
He did get out, yes. I guess maybe Bronn saved it? No. Yeah, you would have used him to kill, but you could use Bronn to save him. Oh, that's pretty Nedley. He can't be saved, but since the core Bronn's effect is a replacement effect, you could actually use Bronn to save him from the Skycell. Which is pretty good.
Yeah, but that doesn't really help.
No, it doesn't. It means you triggered it for no reason.
Just stand Bronn.
And they did mention one more thing that they seem to be wanting to do with a couple of cards. Because we see Peter Baelish as a House Arryn card. We see Skycell. We see the Eyrie. We see Moondor. The Alupin Apart, I think, is supposed to be a reference to the Vale. So, and the fact that they're introducing Clansmen and so on seem to be that they're pushing that angle. And I think a lot of people have asked for that, almost to the point of wishing there were a seventh house or that the Arryn trait was more fleshed out. So people may get their wish.
Yeah, I know. I've been waiting for it for a while.
I don't know. I've never been all that interested in them. I can see why they were excluded originally, because they're a house that isn't yet involved in the play for power.
Yeah, they don't do anything. They just kind of sit back and hide. So I have to see that the HBO series has inspired me a little bit more to enjoy them. Yeah.
If we're getting Rainbow Guard, we really should have House Arryn, right?
Final point for me, there is a card that they spoiled that brings back our deck, John.
Yes.
The Siege Preparations plot. I would definitely use that in the Greyjoy Black Sails.
Black Sails, oh yeah, it's awesome.
That would allow me to replace Fury and comfortably keep manning the city walls.
All right, yeah, let's talk about this plot for a second. I don't really like it that much. I agree. In Black Sails, I agree. Because you kind of want to get that one challenge off to get into the hold. It's important. But in most decks that need this card, the decks that need military battles, basically, they're mostly aggressive-type decks. And only being able to initiate one challenge in the first turn, which is generally when you try and put a plot like this, it does hurt the deck. So,
but the strong start of 6 gold especially keys into Black Sails, where you need to have enough characters to be able to overcommit to that challenge. So it just fuels Black Sails deck really, really well, this card.
I agree in Black Sails, but I'm talking more broadly about other Greyjoy and Stark decks that desperately really want a military battle that isn't a Fury.
I saw that plot, and I actually thought to myself that they would be introducing more events that require, you know, a power struggle or a military battle on the use pile, and then that plot would be a good way to be able to play any of those combination of events. You know, I could have the to be a Kraken or whatever from the military battle, and I could have an X event for the power struggle and another event for the intrigue,
so you're
if I wanted.
Less predictable at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think it's interesting it has all the traits.
Is it funny that the plot called Siege Preparations works absolutely terribly with Siege of Winterfell?
A little bit.
All right, well, we probably won't see this cycle until November?
After Worlds?
I don't know. It depends if there's a 2-month delay or a 1-month delay, but it certainly will not be affecting Gen Con. In fact, we probably won't have CP6 till September.
Mm.
So that means you're looking at November at the earliest for this cycle. But it may affect Worlds. It may affect Stalic. So, who knows? Aloof and Apart wins Stalic.
It would surprise
awesome.
Me.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Peter, especially at such short notice.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. Appreciate it. Today we're going to be talking about another historical snapshot of Thrones. And we're actually talking about 2011. This was the year where we first saw the restricted list appear. It was the year where we first had a problem with a melee game at the Worlds level. And it was also the year that our guest won the Joust Championship at Shalik.
So our guest today is Marty Fuerza Hernandez. So care to introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you for letting me participate in your program. My name is Marty. And I've been playing this game for about 5 years now.
And so, having played it for 5 years, can you still remember 2011?
Yeah, I think so. It was a great year for me.
Excellent. So I think the first thing I wanted to start about talking is how the year started off, because in our last episode we talked about 2010 and how it ended with a lot of people playing all 6 copies of the North Agenda. And that changed right at the end of 2010. They made it so you could only run 3. So at the beginning of the year, what was popular now that the meta had been shaken up by that FAQ?
Well, I think that the 6th agenda time was the worst time of the game ever, probably. And after that, I think that people mainly switched to the Master's Path once it was released. And also there was a lot of Lannister City of Shadows.
Well, Lannister in general had done quite well in 2010. Had won Worlds, so that's not that surprising.
Here in the U.S., we actually saw, because I actually started playing in that year as well, so that was the first year I started playing Thrones was in 2011. And what we saw here in the U.S. and Canada was a whole bunch of Martell Summer. Specifically, once Gaston Grey came out, it became extremely popular. This was before the errata on Gaston Grey, where you could bump a small noble to return, you know, a 6-cost character if you wanted to hand. And Gen Con itself was actually, there was a huge amount of these Martell summer decks at the competitive level. And now none of them won, and actually none of them actually got to the final because Brett Zahler brought the Maester Bob deck, which is basically Bob as a Maester that could stand and discard everyone's board and draw tons of cards and stuff, and it was very rushy. And Greg Atkinson, my hero, played a Knights of the Hollow Hill, which wasn't very popular at the time, that recurred the Viper's Bannerman for card advantage.
I just wanted to jump in there because Knights of the Hollow Hill wasn't very popular at all in the U.S., but I think it saw more play in the European game. Did it not?
Yeah, sure. There was a lot of Targaryen, Knight of the Hollow Hill, which were pretty good decks with jumping characters and also a lot of burn.
And so do you have any idea why it was so much more popular when it came out in Europe than it was in North America?
I don't know. Really, the two metagames historically have been very, very different. I mean, people play really different decks in the States than here in Europe. And also in Spain, it's a little bit different also from the rest of Europe.
Speaking of the metagame changing within that year, and you mentioned that Lannister City of Shadows was very popular, I think to curb Lannister a little bit, there was the introduction of the Restricted List for the very first time, which had Pyromancer's Cache and Castellan of the Rock and Fury of the Lion. So Lannister was one of the only houses forced to make a choice. Did that change the meta for Lannister? Did that push other decks to the top?
Yeah, I think so. Basically, I think that Lannister tried the Pyromancer's Cache away and do all the kneeling with the Alchemist Guild Hall and run really heavy shadow decks.
Maybe we can start talking about the regional season and then finally Gen Con and then Shalik. So the regional season, going up to regionals, we saw a large variety of different types of builds and house representation, all the way up to Gen Con, where we got this huge influx of Martell, like I was talking about. I think 31% of the field was playing Martell. And the rest of them had, you know, about equal representation of the other houses. And at Gen Con, we really saw Martell in the limelight and winning a lot of its games. I think in the top 16, there was 8 Martell players or something. Another big thing happened at Gen Con. The two gentlemen from the Washington, D.C. meta decided to basically throw the melee game and ensure one of them won. And at the time, there was no rules about making king-making or sportsmanship, and it's actually because of this game that they updated the rules the next year to include that type of information in the FAQ. So once Gen Con was over, I guess we got to Shalik. And how different was the field at Shalik? Was there this huge amount of Martell?
Yeah, there was a huge amount of Martell, but not only the summer option. There was also a lot of Martell going the Master's Path agenda, which it was even more popular in 2012. But in 2011, I think it had a great potential also, and lots of Martell players had very competitive decks also.
Now, Spellic, once again, for pretty much every year running, was the biggest tournament in History of Thrones at that point, and it was 120 players that year. And I think because of the timing, it was also one of the only cases in which it got an FAQ just before it. So there was an FAQ between Gen Con and Stalic that changed the Maester's Path so that you couldn't run the same deck that was run at Gen Con. You had to move the chains to a printed Maester.
Yeah, absolutely. That was because of the Bob deck. And also there was also an even more powerful deck. I think that was the Joffrey deck. That was even more powerful than the Bob one. But still, for me, the Master's Agenda was one of the best options as an agenda, especially for Martell, because they had plenty of printed Masters that were good characters, and also the Conclavies were really, really clutch.
So actually, before we jump into the fine details of Stalic, this was the year that Queen of Dragons was released, and everybody, I seem to recall that everybody was expecting there to be a huge change in the game because of Queen of Dragons, that there were going to be lots more Targaryen players. And it looks like from the stats of both Gen Con and Stalic that really didn't happen. Do you have any idea why?
Well, I don't have an idea, but I have an opinion that they were really attracting because people love to play dragons and they really like the characters and the house. But I think that at the beginning, they were not that competitive. So maybe people switched to more competitive decks, more proved competitive decks, like the Martell, for example, or Lannister.
And there was a new agenda introduced in the Queen of Dragons box, but as soon as it was released, it was errated to House Targaryen only, heir to the Iron Throne. So, I mean, I think there were probably a lot of Vera players who were just hoping to be able to build that deck, and it was destroyed right before it was released.
Yeah, there was actually people playtesting with it and saying that they were getting turn one wins, and I think that made a lot of people nervous, and I think that's why it got errated. So let's talk a little bit about the deck you won the Joust with. What were you playing?
I was playing Greyjoy with the Kings of Winter agenda, and it was a classic choke deck, yeah.
And so what cards that were released in that year were sort of really important to deciding to play choke?
The cards that were in the deck, they were really old. Basically, all of them were not released that year. It was like an old-fashioned deck. But I think, I'm not sure about the latest additions to the deck. I think there were, the only one remarkable was the Burnt and Pillaged.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was released that year in 2011.
Yep.
It was the most important addition to the deck, but the rest of the deck was basically the same than in 2010.
And so why choose to play the deck, the same deck?
Yeah, because in 2010, I wanted to play that deck, but the problem was the sixth agenda. It was possible to put an army in the table, only paying one gold, and that made choke impossible to play. But after the FAQ, this kind of deck disappeared, and I thought that choke could be an option again.
So one of the things I like to do when I look at old winning deck lists like yours is I like to go through them and see how many of the cards they were running are restricted now. So I think if we look at your deck by today's standards, you would have 3 restricted cards. Does that sound right?
Fear of Winter, the Agenda, and the Refugees, yeah.
Oh, and Search and Detain, so that's 4.
And the other Refugees, because I had the 2 kind of Refugees. So
oh, 5. 5. And which Asha was that? That was the old Asha, so she's...
The old Asha, yeah, yeah, the one from the first.
So that's 5 restricted cards.
Yeah, not bad.
So what was your best game that day at Shalik? Is there anyone that sticks? Yeah, the one that you think is most memorable, maybe.
The most memorable, maybe it was the top 16, which I played against a guy from Austria, I think. He was playing a Treaty with the Isles deck, Baratheon Treaty with the Isles. And he really rushed me. He reached the 14th power token, and I thought I was lost. But somehow, I managed to claim back. I don't know how I managed to claim back and finally won the match, but it's the toughest match I think that I ever won.
In the finals, you were facing off against the Stark City of Shadows, is that right?
No, Lannister.
Oh, that's right. No, that was in the year. No, sorry, yes, Lannister.
The final and the semi-final, they were similar matches, really similar.
And so Lannister can be a problem for choke because of their ability to get gold in, but Shadows tends to be very gold intensive. So how do you feel about that match, or how did you feel about those matches going into the match?
Well, I feel really prepared for that matchup because I knew the decks that I was facing because they were really popular and I knew how they were built. And I knew that I had to go for my Ice Fisherman and for my Burnt and Pillaged. They were the key cards, and I really looked for them in my setup.
I see. And so, having won the 120-person field with Greyjoy, my favorite house, that makes you one of my heroes. But you're one of my heroes for another reason. You're one of the reasons there is a draw card in Greyjoy. You got a chance to design a card, and you designed a Greyjoy card. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's also my favorite card. I've been playing them since 2008, more or less. Always playing Winter. I still play Greyjoy Winter nowadays. And I think that one of the major problems of the house was the lack of draw and also the lack of the intrigue icon. And I wanted to try to solve these two problems in one card. And also to design a character that was that hadn't been released at the moment. And well, maybe he's not that important in the novels, but it's one of the few Greyjoys that can read a book. So I think it was nice to try to design that character.
Yeah, I think he's seen a lot of play. I think he's basically an auto include in Greyjoy and very popular.
Probably my favorite Greyjoy card as well. Really well designed. I think, you know, it just synergizes so well with the things that Greyjoy wants to do anyways, like the unopposed theme and everything, so.
Yeah, unopposed, mill, maesters even, the Learn Crest can really help. Having an intrigue icon, it's just a nice balance for almost any deck. There's something in there, in that card for you.
Yeah, and well, I always end up using him as a double save with Wendemir.
Yeah.
One of the best abilities that he has in play.
So, one thing that I've always been somewhat curious about, but I'm not sure whether you're allowed to discuss it. So, the card itself has a naval icon, and you must have helped design that before naval icons had come out. Was that a conscious decision, or was that something the developers put in afterwards? Or
yeah, the developers put in afterwards. I didn't know at the moment.
Oh, well, that must have been a nice surprise.
Yeah, well, it was supposed to have stealth, the character. It was my idea. But instead, they removed stealth and they put this naval icon, which is more or less the same on the defensive side. But, well, I would have preferred stealth, but, well, naval icon is not bad.
I like Black Sails a lot, so I think having that naval icon makes him interesting there as well.
Yeah, it helped him fit in every kind of deck, which is what I wanted, to make every Greyjoy player run at least one copy of the character.
Maybe if you want to tell us a little bit about the process of getting art done for the card, because the art on your card really is very nice.
I thought about Nacho Molina because I knew him in an event in Madrid, I think. And he was a really nice guy. And, well, I wanted him to do the drawings. But I had another art in mind. I mean, it really surprised me when it was released. Because, I told them to be like kind of knight or something like this at the back of the picture, and I ended up like a kind of a monk that I really didn't like it at first, but well, finally I get used to it. But I really like the reader as a character with that mustache. It's nice.
Quite nice. So, did you get to receive a print of the painting or of the art in full size?
Yes, I have one at home. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. That would be pretty neat to have, I think. So, as a retrospective, if at the end of the year 2011, and you were looking back at it, what would you say the biggest problems with the game at that point were, or the things that you most wanted to change? So at the end of 2010, a lot of people were complaining about the six agendas, and that got changed. At the end of 2011, what were people complaining about?
Well, without any doubt, the master's agenda, for sure. For me, it's been one of the worst agendas in the history of the game. I never liked it, in fact.
And so, I mean, we all know what happened to it in the end. So it had already been errated so that you could only move it to printed maesters. It eventually got restricted as well, and then the conclave got restricted. Lots of things changed. But in 2011, what did you think they should do to the agenda? Or what did you think they should do to those decks?
well, my opinion is a little bit extreme, but I think that they would have to ban the agenda. I mean, even now, with all the restrictions, it's still a really powerful agenda, even now.
Yeah, I agree.
At the moment, it was terrible.
So one of the reasons it's such a powerful agenda, apparently, it was designed when everyone was playing the six North agendas. So when they interviewed, I don't remember who it was, Nate or Damon, in the Two Champs, One Chumps, they went over why they designed this agenda, and they felt that it should be competitive with the six agendas, which then got changed and restricted. So that kind of explains it, but it doesn't necessarily forgive it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that the introduction of the restricted list was, or the ban of the six agendas, was a better solution than to introduce a new agenda that was so powerful and so difficult to control.
Speaking of the restricted list, that's one of the things that I really like about this game. When I came to it, was the way they approached the restricted list. But I wasn't there when it was first released, when it was first announced. What was the general reaction to this model for restricted list that was different from a lot of other card games?
Well, at first, people didn't like it. That's the truth. People didn't like it because they wanted to play all the cards that they bought, and they were really disappointed. People was disappointed. But I think that after some months, the game was became healthier, much healthier, and people embrace it, really embraced it. Yeah, and I think that now people are really happy with the restricted list in general terms.
Are you looking so? Actually, it's sort of a two-sided question, because the first is I wanted to know, back in 2011, you had just won the tournament, and the next cycle that was coming was the Tourney of Champions cycle, which was changing designers to Damon Stone instead of Nate French. How did you feel about the next cycle that was coming?
Well, the next cycle for me was one of the best of the game. There were really powerful characters, of course, but I think it was quite balanced in the end. I mean, coming from the Masters, everything was better. I think it was easy to do something better than the Masters.
Well, one of the things that I heard about that cycle coming out, people liked that it focused on in-house characters, while Masters and the Defenders of the North cycle had focused on neutrals.
Yeah, I think this is really important, because a lot of people play this game because we like the novels, we like the important characters, and, well, we are not especially interested in Masters or Wildlings or characters that are not that important in the novels. I mean, everyone supports the house, more or less, and we like to play the important characters of the house.
I guess it's not really a specific question, but people keep talking about which deck types are on top, and not just whether they're, you know, Maesters or Wildlings or whatever, but which deck types are on top. And the Maester's Path was supposed to be a sort of combo agenda, although I don't know if it really played out to that. So how would you say 2011 were for Rush and Aggro and Combo and those deck types?
I think that control decks were really, really powerful at 2011. Especially Martel Masters, which, well, Martel is a really special case, because they were control decks, but they were able to run a lot and to rush you also. And that made them really, really scary, because they controlled you, and then in one turn with two despairs, they were able to grab a lot of power in one single turn. So they were really difficult to face. And also Lannister was at a great moment then, with lots of control effects. And in a long-term match, it was really difficult to beat them.
And so you think that Rush was at one of its lower points?
Yes.
Aside from the Martell?
definitely. Yeah, because we cannot consider Martel Rush or that Martel type Rush. They were like a control rush deck. Strange thing. But pure Rush, I mean Baratheon, it was really difficult to play Baratheon at that time. I'm also a Baratheon player. I've played them in a lot of big tournaments. And for me, it was not an option in 2011.
And do you think that Rush is seeing a resurgence now, that it has a little bit more of a chance with, you know, some of the prized cards coming and Noble Cause being printed? And
yeah, I think so. Maybe not with Noble Cause. We will see. I've been trying it a little bit, and it's difficult to overcome the one card draw. But the prized dynamics, sure, will be very, very helpful for the Rush decks. I'm sure about it.
Mm-hmm. So, John?
No, go ahead. I was actually going to say I don't have anything.
Okay, well, I was wondering if there's anything, any other big points that we missed or stories you want to tell, either about the card design or the tournament or the year, things that you want to make sure that we get into the interview.
Well, I think that one interesting point was that the Greyjoy Choke was not one of the top options at the moment. I mean, it was really surprising for me to win, because I was sure that I wasn't playing the favorite option of people. I think that Martell or Lannister would win the tournament. And, well, I'm really happy to play Greyjoy at that moment, because, well, I was, I don't know how to explain it, loyal to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt really good to win against the odds, let's say.
Well, it's probably a slight advantage for you that they were actually not thought of as a competitive house at the moment, because a lot of people probably didn't play test versus choke, so they might not have been able to know exactly how to react to that type of deck with their own, and it would throw them off kilter. Do you think that helps you at all? Or
Yeah, I think it helped me a lot. And also, if you have a look at the deck, it was a deck that really required playing the plots really at the exact moment. And for example, with Blockade or Fear of Winter, they were really key in a lot of games, and people sometimes didn't know how to react to this plot line.
Speaking of Choke, I think that one of my favorite things about Choke, and maybe this is one of the reasons you chose to run it, is that Choke is a deck that isn't necessarily all that hard to play with, but it's one that your opponent constantly has to make decisions. So you have a few decisions to make, but you can generally play a Choke deck for quite a long time. But your opponent, when they're playing a Choke deck and they're tired, all they have to do is slip up once and use their gold the wrong way once, and you've probably won the game. So you're always forcing them to make choices.
Yeah, I really like that too. And I also like Choke decks because we also play with limited resources. I mean, my gold curve was very tight, and I had a persistent lack of draw also, so my resources were limited also. And I like this kind of matches where everyone is limited and every decision counts.
All right. Well, I think that's everything then, unless John has thought of anything else.
No, that's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and do this retrospect with us. It's great to have Champion from that year doing it with us.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure for me. Very nice to participate in something like this.
Okay, perfect. Pues muchas gracias una vez más.
Perfecto. Muchas gracias.
All right, well, that's it. That's our new cycle, first impressions, and a look back at 2011. What about this coming week, John?
There's a lot of regionals, and I guess they're all regionals, right? So we got a Chilean, we got a Spanish, we got two Swedish, and Illinois.
Yep.
All going on?
That's right. It's a busy weekend for regionals. I'm surprised that both Swedish regionals are the same date. I might have that wrong. But in addition to that, there's the Championnat National, the French national champions in Nantes, running from Friday to Sunday. So the French nationals, making that the second nationals for which I'll have records. I think the Chilean nationals happened far earlier in the previous season.
I don't think the French championship should count because they actually play a different game. They play Iron Throne, right?
Tone de fer. They don't play Game of Thrones. So I hope I can get the stats for those. I've gotten the stats for every other French event this season, so I hope this will not be an exception.
So next week's episode is going to be focused on Barra.
For real.
And we're going to be focusing on the two decks that Alex mentioned earlier. So it's going to be a Barra Knights of the Hollow Hill that made the cut in the UK National and then did a strong performance at a 4-2 in New York. And then the undefeated deck in New York in the Swiss, which was a Barra Maester's Path.
Yeah, I hope that we can, starting from when we air that episode, Barra's stats will improve, and we can attribute it entirely to our focus on that house.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.